On this podcast, our guest is Umberto Fontova. Does that sound like a slightly exotic name? Well, it has a Spanish ring. Indeed, it is a Cuban name. And Umberto Fontova lived in Castro's Cuba from the age of 0 to 7. You got out early. Obviously, that was a decision by your parents rather than by you alone.
Exactly. My father, in fact, was a political prisoner at the time. So it was primarily my mother who got us out, me and my sister and my brother, and moved to the U.S.
How old are you now?
58.
So you spent 51 years in America. Of course, you are a very active American journalist, not only in political affairs, where you definitely take what could properly be called a conservative or right-wing position, but you're also a great sportsman. Of your 4 or 5 books, the first two were not about Cuba, were not about international political issues, but about hunting and related undertakings.
Spear fishing. But I did manage to get in a few jabs, even in those, at Fidel Castro and Che Guevara, because as most people know, Cuba was communist, and there was a lot of gun grabbing. Gun ownership was banned in my home country, so naturally that kind of spilled over into my books about hunting and fishing.
I want to start with an historical parallel to the success of the Cuban Revolution, right, and Fidel Castro's arrival in Havana on a memorable day. But the historical parallel goes back to late 1917, when there arrives in St. Petersburg Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, who has been transported on a so-called SEAL train by the German government, a SEAL train across Europe and back to St. Petersburg, where they want him to assist in and further intensify the partial revolution that has occurred in Russia. The Tsar has abdicated. Kerensky is the head of the provisional government, which calls itself a social democratic government and has insisted it will establish democratic forms and be that sort of quasi-European government now. Now, if you now flip forward again quickly to Castro's arrival after their victories and after the departure of Fulgencio Batista, the dictator of Cuba, and Castro announces on that very day and in early speeches from there on, which get a lot of play in the American press and in the world press, that he is there to establish democracy. He has ended totalitarianism in Cuba, and the Cuban people will now be free and go forward into a great dawn of a democratic government, which will give them physical security, better education, better work, and in general, they will march towards the sunlit uplands of freedom and fulfillment. He did not announce himself a communist, as Lenin, of course, I should have said, when he gives his opening speech to the populace who surround him, literally as he gets off the train, declares he's there to lead this revolution into the necessary proper territory mapped out by Marx years ago. A communist regime will be established, or rather a regime that will establish socialism, transform the economy, and move towards the ultimate goal of communism. So they're very different. Lenin announces what's going on. Castro either represents himself correctly or falsely as merely a person who wants to wants to lead the country in democratic reforms. Was Castro then speaking his true mind, or was he falsifying from the beginning?
He was falsifying from the very beginning. As a matter of fact, there are some parallels, because what he broadcast and what the Cubans thought was coming was precisely a social democratic government. As a matter of fact, in my book, I use the term Cuban Kerenskys to the people that he appointed. See, when he came into Havana in 1959, in the early days, he was actually prime minister. There was a president, and there was an entire cabinet made up of what I call Cuban Kerenskys. But his brother Raul, for instance, had a KGB handler ever since 1953. Che Guevara, his left-handed man, had a KGB handler since 1957. And as documented in my books, that first week after he entered Havana, he was already meeting nightly with Soviet GRU agents, not KGB agents at that time, GRU agents. He was meeting with them secretly, nightly, to plan the Stalinization of Cuba. That's January of 1959, folks.
Here's a quotation from our friend Fidel Castro, who says, I'm not sure what the date of this is. It must have been long after he announced himself as a communist, but he says, I was a man who was lucky enough to have discovered a political theory, a man who was caught up in the whirlpool of Cuba's political crisis long before becoming a fully-fledged communist. Discovering Marxism was like finding a map in the forest. He says that in 1971 in a speech given in Chile. So it's a little bit unclear even there whether he's saying, I was not a communist when I came to power, but I rapidly became one, or whether he's saying, I was a Marxist, I was educated in and inspired by Marxism before we got to Havana, but I held it secret for a while. It's still a little ambiguous as to whether we pushed him towards communism by our Bay of Pigs invasion, by our general negativism towards him at the governmental level, even though we were very friendly towards him at the journalistic level. But did we push him there?
No.
Or was he there secretly all along?
Not only were we very friendly towards him in the journalistic, we were very friendly to him at a governmental level. As a matter of fact, as I fully document in the book, and this is a quote from the U.S. ambassador to Cuba from 1957 to 1959, he says, without U.S. help, Castro would have never taken power in Cuba. Now, some of our listeners are going, oh my God, Neil's got a crackpot Bircher on his show. Oh my heavens. But folks, I'm here to tell you that it was not a conspiracy by the Illuminati. The CIA backed morally and financially and with propaganda, Castro's July 26th movement. Not because the CIA was a part of the communist plot, but the CIA was always made up of East Coast liberals, as Ivy League types, and they bought into the mythology by Cuba's Kerensky's that their movement, Castro's movement, was a social democratic movement. I've got a quote.
Who were some of those Cuban Kerenskys? Are they still memorable and identifiable?
Now, most of them, Pastor, you got to figure most of them were in their 40s in 1959. But we have the man who was president of Cuba, technically, at the time. His name was Manuel Urrutia.
Was he a veteran of the Sierra Maestra beginnings of the revolution, or was he a Havanan who remained there and then joined forces with Castro?
No, he was a Cuban judge
who
had exonerated Castro in 1953 for a terrorist attack that Fidel Castro's movement had made against the army barracks. And he was a judge. We hear that Cuba was a dictatorship under Batista, but it had a completely independent judiciary, and his judge, Manuel Urrutia, basically exonerated Castro.
That was the very trial in which Castro announced, history will exonerate me.
Exactly. And he was exonerated, so naturally, when Castro's people took over, they appointed typical. It would be hard. I mean, if you could look under a dictionary and find useful idiot, yeah, Mr. Manuel Urrutia, Jose Miró, who was another high official, these gentlemen did not have a totalitarian bone in their body. They were genuine social democrats, but they were very easily manipulated and put aside. As a matter of fact, as documented in the book, the Cuban Revolution devoured its own children, as it were, more ravenously than did the French Revolution. all members of Castro's original cabinet in Cuba either wound up dead, in prison, or in exile within 2 years.
It is interesting that in your new book, The Longest Romance, you refer to many of these men who were important in the early Castro government as, quote, useful idiots. And that you're actually quoting a man we've already mentioned, namely Lenin, who speaks of some of the friends of the early revolution and of the beginnings of the Soviet Union as useful idiots. Use them for what they're worth. They believe that we're somehow more spiritual and more decent people than we are. I don't know what revolutionary intensity and firmness and resolve we have, but that's all to the good. We use them until we need to discard them. That was Lenin's view, and he says that to Trotsky and others. And you're saying that was essentially Castro's view. He was using a lot of useful idiots.
Well, as a matter of fact, the exact phrase I use in my book is, Lenin coined the term, but Castro became the virtuoso at employing them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, there was nothing to compare with the amount of adulation that...
I'm an older guy, and I actually remember the beginning of the Cuban Revolution when he was still up in the Sierra Maestra, mm-hmm. and how later on, after a number of victories, they marched into Cuba. I remember TV shots of Castro sitting on a tank, I guess, smoking a cigar as they roll into the main section of Cuba. At that time, the world press was, I guess, rather enthusiastic. He was a heroic figure. He almost could have been played by Errol Flynn if Flynn had a beard and a Spanish accent. That view of him was particularly presented to this country by the Times man in Cuba, one Herbert Matthews, who I think may have got a Pulitzer Prize later on for his coverage.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I devote a whole chapter to Herbert, but what I say is, okay, let's cut those guys a little bit of slack, because in 57 and 59, nobody really knew. A lot of Cubans knew who I was, and boy, were they banging on State Department doors. They were banging on CIA doors in Washington, and they never got a hearing. But most people had no idea. So it's one thing to have believed all these things in 1957 and 59. But for heaven's sakes, when in 2012, Newsweek magazine calls Cuba one of the best countries on earth to live, you really, really have got to slap yourself on the side of the head to believe it. And that's exactly what Newsweek did, and it's documented in my book.
I didn't remember that they did that. That was just before their death.
It was right before they were sold to the Daily Beast. Right.
Yes. Well, what, as you see it, is the real hidden history, still hidden from some, of the long Castro run in Cuba? What really happened? What terror was worked and upon whom? How many judicial or non-judicial murders occurred in general? And for that matter, what was the economic situation? What is it to this moment? What's a proper evaluation of the Castroite Cuba from then, 1957, down to the present moment, 2013?
Our listeners would be well to keep in back of their minds the opening paragraph of my book. The Castro regime jailed and tortured political prisoners at a higher rate than did Stalin's regime during the Great Terror. Castro's regime murdered more political prisoners in its first 3 years in power than Hitler's regime murdered in its first 6 years in power. 20 times as many people have died trying to flee Castro's regime as have died trying to flee the East German regime. So,
part of the beginning of that paragraph confuses me. It's true that Hitler didn't kill too many Germans in the early years of Nazi dominance, though he sent lots of them to concentration camps to wash their minds, so to speak. But Stalin, during the time of the great purge trials of 35 to 37, both through those trials, but then out in the general country, is supposed to have killed, according to various scholarly sources, as many as 1 to 2 million Russians. And that's only a portion of the 30 to 40 million deaths by state, so to speak, that the Stalinists are responsible
for. And that's why I don't say that he killed more than Stalin. I said he jailed and tortured political prisoners at a higher rate. If you read Anne Applebaum's, which you probably have, the Gulag, you find that at any one time during the 30s, during the Great Terror, there were about 2 million Russians in the various camps.
To be sure, they died ultimately, most of them did, but without judicial process at the beginning of their incarceration.
And in fact,
I see your point.
Castro's judicial system was imported from the Soviet Union. At one time in 1961, Cuba, which was a nation of 6.3 million people at the time, had 350,000 people jailed for political crimes. If you do the calculations, which I did, that is why I say at a higher rate than Stalin. The Soviet population in the 30s and the 40s was, 180 million, something like that. The calculations I've done, I arrived, and I used the wording very carefully, at a higher rate than Stalin's regime.
And how many still linger in prison or get thrown into prison and or even get tortured these days?
Right now, as a matter of fact, just last week, by the way, Amnesty International decried a wave of terror against Cuba's dissidents and named five different Cubans as official Amnesty International prisoners of conscience. We don't know. Cuba has the highest jail population in the world.
Really?
That is according, they jail according to Reporters Without Borders. Reporters Without Borders is not a Cuban exile organization, by the way. It's a Paris-based organization. And they jail the most journalists in the world, much by percentage of population. Great. As a matter of fact, Castro's Cuba jails only slightly fewer journalists than does China, with a population of what? 1.5 million? Cuba's population right now is 11 million.
If I were a Stalinist journalist, or a post-Stalinist but still essentially loyal communist journalist in the Soviet Union, I would instantly remind you of the maxim, to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs. And I would say that what was gained through some of these repressions and some of this hardline stuff, what was gained was a tremendous improvement in the economic fortunes of the common Cuban people, a tremendous increase in educational attainment, and the provision of wonderful medical services. This is, and that's what Newsweek had in mind, one of the best countries in the world in terms of how common people fare at the hands of the government.
And where did Newsweek get these statistics? They got them from a Stalinist totalitarian regime. Let's do that. Let's go to healthcare because that's the most off-quoted. In 1958, Cuba had the 13th lowest infant mortality rate. 13th lowest, not in the Western Hemisphere, in the world.
That sounds pretty
good. In 1958, Cuba had a lower infant mortality rate than France, than Germany, and than Israel.
In 1958, at the beginning of the revolution.
Before the revolution.
Before the revolution,
took over January 1st of 1959. So obviously there's still going to be some overlap in the achievements of pre-Castro Cuba, when it was a free and prosperous nation spilling over. So I'm using the figures right at the end of Batista's rule. In 1958, Batista's Cuba had the 13th lowest infant mortality rate on Earth. Cubans enjoyed in 1958 a higher per capita income than half of Europe. Cuba had a higher per capita income than Ireland, than Portugal, than Spain, than Austria, than Greece. It was right equivalent with Italy's.
Okay, then fast forward to the present moment, and what do we see?
Haitians who are 60 miles away will not emigrate to Cuba. That's what it is. Cuba now has the highest poverty rate in the Western Hemisphere. But again, the reason that we don't know that, unless you read my books, is because people like Newsweek and so forth get their information straight from the propaganda ministry of a totalitarian regime, which would have been considered insane 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, now, what are the certifiable numbers regarding infant mortality presently?
Presently, if you rank it against the rest of the world, Cuba is 47th from the top. And that's if you believe the regime's figures. I interviewed several doctors who defected from Cuba that said that the figures are completely bogus, and also what keeps them artificially low is Cuba's policy of forced abortions. Forced abortions. So naturally that keeps infant mortality rate, because any pregnancy that even hints at a problem, boom, gets, shall we say, terminated. And these are forced abortions. A lot of people in Miami will testify, both the victims of the abortion and the doctors who were forced to perform them are in Miami, and they're interviewed for money.
Yeah. What about political operations and political, quote, freedom? Quotation from a New Yorker article about Cuba, an article of 1992. He is reported to have said to the reporter, John Newhouse, "All criticism is opposition. All opposition is counter-revolutionary."
That is true.
Which sounds like anybody who criticizes us is against the revolution and deserves punishment.
That is pretty much still the case. And here's the issue. You know, after all is said and done, the Heritage Foundation just put out its index of economic freedom in the world. And despite all the talk and all the writing that you hear to me about the reforms going on in Cuba under Raul, Cuba has not budged from the bottom of the list in the last 5 years. It is still right there next to North Korea. You see, that's really all that needs to be said. And again, I stress, Reporters Without Borders, not a Cuban exile organization, a French intellectual type of organizations, which would, you know, the type of people who generally speaking would be favorably disposed towards somebody like the Castro Revolution. Cuba jails the most prisoners, reporters per capita on earth, more than Zimbabwe.
Well, how do ordinary Cubans feel these days? You know what? One thing that comes to mind as I read your stuff and as I've been reading up some of your articles is that wonderful film of 10 or more years ago, the Buena Vista Social Club. Those wonderful musicians and the street scenes in Havana. It looked like a rather threadbare and poverty-stricken Havana, but at the same time, people looked sort of relaxed, happy, and kind of committed to their way of life.
Well,
what do we really know about Cuban public opinion?
What we really, I prefer to look at the famous saying, it's attributed to Tony Blair most recently, but I'm sure you could go back centuries might have said, all you really need to know about a country is how many people are trying to get into it and trying to get out of it. In 1958, again, the last year of Batista's government, all during the 40s and the 50s, when to read the media, Cuba was a horrible, wretched, mafia-dominated, Cuba enjoyed net immigration, primarily from Europe. In 1958, as a matter of fact, more Americans lived in Cuba than Cubans lived in the U.S. And this is at a time when Cubans were perfectly free to emigrate with all of their property and all of their family. At that point, more Cuba was inundated with immigrant wannabes primarily from the first world, because Cuba was almost right there with them as a first world country, but with more opportunity at the time. Since the revolution, 2 million Cubans have fled against enormous obstacles. As I said, 20 in the Florida Straits, we don't know, but the estimates that I gathered from people who flew rescue flights and so forth is that between 70 and 90,000 Cubans have drowned, died of exposure, or been ripped apart by sharks trying to flee a nation that previously had people going into it at almost the same rate.
Those are astonishing numbers. Did I hear you correctly? 70 to 90,000 have perished in the water trying to cross over.
There's an outfit called the Cuba Archive. And let me add that this outfit has been quoted favorably in such places as the Wall Street Journal, as the Miami Herald, which is part of the McClatchy Corporation. Their figures have appeared there. And I use some of those figures. I also interviewed the gentleman who ran the Rafter Rescue Center in Key West. And he says those figures are actually a little low. I said, oh, my goodness, how can you say that? He says, because he used to get communications from people who were leaving Cuba. Look, Joe Blow, five people have just left on a raft. Please see that they get there, and please attend to them carefully. And he said he started keeping the records of the people who were said to be leaving Cuba and of those who actually made it or rescued. And he did the math of that, and he says, I think that, you know, probably about 100,000 have perished. Now, we're talking 50 years now, remember.
The title of your book, once again, The Longest Romance, the Mainstream Media, and Fidel Castro. Would you say that the romance still continues, or don't we have in American more or less mainstream media a fair amount of disillusion about the Cuban regime, and also the sense that inevitably it must change and go towards the beginnings of true democracy, if only because of the incapacity of Fidel, and if only because with higher education levels the Cuban public is demanding more political freedom.
Yeah. The tone has changed somewhat, but every time that you read the mildest criticism of the Castro regime, and like I say, the criticism does not approach what the criticism was in the media about Augusto Pinochet or Anastasia Somoza or even Batista. But anytime you read the mildest criticism about, say, political repression in Cuba, the next sentence, certainly the next paragraph will have, but they have great free health care and great free education. It's always offset by that. And I say, this very week is a perfect example of that. When you see the birthday announcements for Castro in the media, there is not a single mention of political repression, of torture. But when Pinochet perished, those items headlined the media. Headline, torturer, murderer, Pinochet, Castroids. Oh, and what we always hear is, gosh, isn't it wonderful how he stood up to the U.S., stood up to 10 U.S. presidents. That's another little cliche that we hear very often, isn't it, sir?
Yeah. What if we as government had remained more friendly and accommodating to Cuba rather than gone to the point of the missile crisis, a point at which, before the Soviets took the weapons out of Cuba, Che Guevara was urging them to use them against the United States to do nuclear bombing of, I guess, New York. But Khrushchev withdrew the weapons, and the bitterness remained, of course, about the Cuban missile crisis. That must have intensified, or should it have intensified, Castro's loyalty to Moscow.
Exactly. And it would have been literally impossible for the U.S. to dangle and to throw more carrots in front of Fidel Castro from the years 57 to 59. I've got a quote from Robert Reynolds, who was the CIA's Caribbean desk chief from 57 to 59 who said, me and my staff were all fidelistas. I've got another quote from another CIA operative in Santiago, Cuba, Robert Whiteco was his name. He says, everyone in the CIA and everyone in the U.S. State Department except Ambassador Smith were pro-Castro. And Ambassador Smith himself said, without U.S. help, Castro would have never taken power. Okay, so much for getting him into power. In other words, the CIA was actually funding his movement. Folks, I'm not a Bircher. Don't get the wrong idea. They bought into the fact that he was a social democrat. As a matter of fact, in the recent movie Che by Steven Soderbergh, you see a film movie where Che Guevara is talking to a radio set, a very sophisticated radio called Radio Rebelde. And he is going into the mic saying, gosh, the U.S. is intervening on Batista's side. They're saying, folks, the very mics, the very radio set that he was talking to had been given to him by the CIA, who had placed an arms embargo against Batista. And
you know, if only in a brief footnote or sidebar, one needs to explain that. Why would American policy, as conveyed through the CIA, but I assume also originating in the State Department and approved by the then president, why would American policy have favored the toppling of Batista when Batista was friendly to various American interests, not to mention major corporate interests who were making, American corporate interests, making money
as
in Cuba?
As a matter of fact, he was not all that friendly to them. In 1956, a major tunnel, the Almendares Tunnel, some people call it the Havana Tunnel, was being built in Havana. And so naturally, everyone expected, the U.S. ambassador, everybody expected Batista, the so-called U.S. lackey, who's nothing of the sort, to give the contract. In fact, the contract went to a West German firm. And whoops, that got the U.S. State Department a little bit peeved. And also at that time, Cuba was undergoing a lot of import substitution. Cubans eat rice every night. I still eat rice every night. We love it. And 90% of the rice that Cubans ate at the time was imported from the United States, primarily from my home state of Louisiana. Well, Cuba started growing its own rice, and they started importing some of it from elsewhere. That also got the State Department a little peeved. But it wasn't that kind of stuff. That combined with the CIA and State Department affection for social democrats. The CIA at the time was backing the social democrats, the Christian democrats in Italy, in Europe, in the rest of Latin America, and they just thought that Castro's movement was part of that same social democratic international. You know, there's nothing sinister here. I'm not implying a conspiracy theory. I'm implying useful idiocy.
We're almost out of time, Umberto, but the payoff question is this, and in fact, I can go back to Lenin, who showed up a lot in our conversation, because he gave a title to a pamphlet he wrote, which gives you a question that can often be raised. The title of that pamphlet was simply, What is to be Done? And I put that to you. With regard to Cuba still lingering in the throes of or in the wake of the Castro Revolution, what is to be done by us, by the Cubans, by the rest of the world?
And this is going to blow you away, and I wish we'd give me another show. Impose a genuine embargo. Yeah. Now you're going to say, but that's crazy, Umberto. Folks, the U.S. for the last 8 years has been among Cuba's biggest food suppliers, and more, twice as many Americans have been visiting Cuba in the last 5 years as visited during the 50s when it was known as a tourist playground. So I'm setting up the next show. Thanks a lot, Milt.
Well, I can't resist the follow-up question to that, but that means starving the Cuban people, doesn't it?
No, it will not. It is starving the Cuban regime. As a matter of fact, Cuban dissidents in the U.S., some of them are visiting the U.S. right now, Miami, are doing the same thing that Nelson Mandela did when he visited. He says, This constructive engagement does not work. Embargoes will starve my jailers, not our people, because all of that food that is going to Cuba from the United States does not reach the Cuban people anyway. It stays in the hotels, the tourist industry that is owned by the regime. It is consumed by tourists, which enrich the regime, entrench the regime, and thus embolden the people in Cuba with the greatest interest in maintaining the Stalinist repressive status quo.
Umberto Fontova, I need to thank you for joining us today and for holding up most effectively and most persuasively against my troublemaking questions. This has been a very impressive analysis, and I'm happy to recommend to all who are listening the book in which this analysis is fully developed by Umberto Fontova. The title of the book, The Longest Romance, The Mainstream Media and Fidel Castro, published by Encounter Books. So, Umberto, thanks again for an excellent conversation.
My pleasure. I had a lot of fun, Milt. Looking forward to the next one.
Very good.